This is the World Vision Report. In India, riding a rickshaw for the 21st century.
You can get your mobile recharge on rickshaws. These guys can get you the newspapers. They can deposit your utility bills.
In Lebanon, Ethiopian domestic workers face all kinds of abuse.
Even at 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock at night, they told her to work, you know, especially in the Ramadan period. She said she never sleep. She was afraid they're going to kill her.
And in Bolivia, we discover an instrument that looks like an armadillo, but plays like an angel.
Algo espiritual dentro de él mediante la música que emite.
I believe that the charango has something spiritual in the music it makes.
Around the world with the World Vision Report, I'm Lita Hartman. First, this hour's news. Welcome to the World Vision Report. I'm Lita Hartman, in for Peggy Wehmeyer. Journalist Roxana Saberi was released from an Iranian prison a couple of weeks ago. Her case highlights the dangers reporters face in many parts of the world: censorship, beatings, imprisonment, even death. The Committee to Protect Journalists estimates that around 125 journalists are in jail around the world at any given time. Most of them are local reporters without the clout to secure a quick release. We spoke with Robert Mahoney, Deputy Director of the Committee to Protect Journalists. I asked him to explain why this is a human rights issue.
If you stifle a free press, you allow any government to act with impunity, to act with any accountability to the broader public. And those societies which look from a human rights perspective as sick societies are the ones that do not have a free press.
What sort of poverty or justice stories aren't getting out there? What are we missing?
Well, we're missing lots. Ordinary citizens have no way of fighting back against injustice, whether it's through, you know, corrupt officials who could take their land, who could take their goods and property, and they have no way of getting those grievances aired. It can be something that affects all of us. It's not just the individuals that are immediately affected. If you take something like the tainted food scandals in China, the Chinese government did not want those reported. And so things such as melamine in infant formula, it was kept quiet for the longest time. And it's only when the government can't keep it quiet any longer, when children are getting sick or dying, that we find out that manufacturers have been cutting corners and putting this poisonous substance in their product. With a free and functioning press, that kind of crime, because it is a crime, would have been exposed much earlier.
And are there especially egregious examples of crackdowns on reporters, you know, who were jailed or threatened or even killed for just doing their jobs?
I can give you an example of one such person in Burma who was recently sentenced to 59 years in prison for his work in exposing the lack of adequate government response to a cyclone which hit Burma last year. His name is Zaganar, he organized some relief efforts with his own resources for the victims of this cyclone. He videotaped it, tried to publish that videotape, and spoke to the international media, and the Burmese authorities clamped down on him very, very severely. That's just one very egregious example. But you can see in some countries, such as the Philippines and in Russia, journalists who criticize are just killed. It's not particularly expensive to take a contract out on anyone, and journalists included. And for a few thousand dollars, we've been seeing journalists who have been outright murdered for their work.
Robert Mahoney is Deputy Director of the Committee to Protect Journalists. Thank you so much.
You're more than welcome. It's a pleasure talking to you.
Violence flared again last week in Nigeria's troubled Niger Delta region, the center of Africa's largest oil industry. Militants have threatened to blockade key waterways in the delta to prevent the export of crude oil. They say they're fighting for a fair share of the profits from oil. Each year, the Nigerian government earns billions of dollars from oil exports. But most people who live on Nigeria's oil reserves are locked in abject poverty. Oil was first discovered more than 50 years ago near the small village of Aloibri. Sarah Simpson paid a visit there and spoke with one of the village chiefs.
The village of Aloibri lies in a forest clearing It's this jumble of crumbling concrete homes, near naked children run and play among rickety market tables filled with tiny packets of salt and sugar for sale. The discovery of oil here has brought change to Loibri, but not for the better, says one of its chiefs. Chief Sunday Ikpesu is among a handful of villagers old enough to remember the days before oil.
That's the difference.
It was different. Different in the sense that Oloibiri was quite a nice place. It was just a village.
But was nice.
Ikpesu is in his mid-70s, a grand old age in a country where most don't make it past middle age. His eyes are clouded and his shoulders hunched, but his memories of when the oil-hungry foreigners arrived remain clear.
At the time, we didn't know what they told us, that they were looking for oil.
At the time, they told us they were looking for oil.
They didn't tell us.
But they didn't tell us the type of oil they were looking for.
But Ikpesu, then 19 and eager to practice his mission school English, asked lots of questions. Europeans had come to the Niger Delta before in search of a thick red vegetable oil called palm oil. Perhaps that's what they were looking for.
They said, no, what they were looking for?
They said, no. They were looking for oil they could get from the soil.
The farmers and fishermen of Oloibiri had never heard of oil from the soil, but when the prospectors struck crude in 1956, the whole village was gripped by excitement and talk of riches to come.
We were excited.
We were excited.
Naturally.
Naturally.
But residents of Oloibiri stopped celebrating long ago. Billions of dollars worth of oil have been pumped from the Niger Delta, but decades of corrupt military and civilian governments have left the communities here impoverished and angry. A few miles from Oloibiri, giant flares burn off natural gas emitted as a byproduct of oil production. It's gas that could be used to power local homes and industry, but it's not. Electricity lines reach villages like Oloibiri, but corruption and mismanagement mean the cables rarely carry any power. There are no jobs, too few schools, and even fewer hospitals, say residents. Many young men growing up in the Delta today also feel cheated. The region is awash with militant groups that want a share of the oil wealth to go to the communities that live atop the oil. Oil infrastructure and oil company personnel are frequently the targets of their attacks. Robert Nadioni has grown up in the shadow of big oil. He's in his 30s, educated, and a surveyor by profession. But he understands the anger among some of his peers. He says if he wasn't able to earn his money legitimately, he too would likely turn to violence.
If I was an uneducated youth in the community, I would have been so hostile.
Chief Ikpesu doesn't approve of the violence of the militant gangs, but he shares their sense of injustice, and he feels neglected by the government.
Why haven't they done anything for us?
Are we not part of Nigeria?
Are we not part of Nigeria?
What have we done to have made us suffer?
What have we done to have made us suffer like this?
In a recent move, the Nigerian government established a new ministry to tackle the deep-seated problems of the Niger Delta. But residents here say what they need is electricity, schools, hospitals and jobs, not another layer of government bureaucracy. For the World Vision Report, I'm Sarah Simpson in Oloibiri in Nigeria's Niger Delta.
In Beirut, there are more than 50,000 domestic workers who come from other countries. Most of them are from Ethiopia. They go to Beirut in search of a well-paying job and a better life. But some of them end up in a nightmare of abuse. Will Everett reports.
A half dozen women crowd around a TV in a shelter in central Beirut. They're from Sri Lanka, the Philippines, and Ethiopia. And they're watching the Philippine version of Wheel of Fortune.
He win 1 million pesos. We're happy for him.
These women came here in search of their own fortunes, working as maids and nannies, only to find themselves victims of abuse. Some were beaten or raped, others simply weren't paid. The shelter is run by Caritas, a Catholic charity. Nirmala is the counselor here. She wants me to meet a 29-year-old Ethiopian woman named Indrani, who has lived at the shelter for more than a year. Both of them ask that their last names not be used. But when we knock on her door, she won't come out. Nirmala shrugs, as though she isn't surprised.
Sometimes she doesn't want to talk about that. Like, it's so painful to remember.
Indrani was 19 when she came to Beirut to work as a maid. She found a live-in job with a well-to-do family who promised to pay her $100 a month. It wasn't great pay, but it was a start. The job turned out to be a nightmare. She worked 7 days a week and was frequently beaten.
Even at 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock at night, they told her to work, you know, especially in the Ramadan period. She said she never sleep. She was afraid they're going to kill her.
For 9 years, she wasn't permitted to leave the ninth floor apartment. She had become a prisoner.
I asked her that, how did you stay 9 years without trying to run away? She told me the house is ninth floor. She asked me, where do I run away? The door is locked, you know. Without somebody inside the family helping her, she cannot get out.
Finally, the 18-year-old son took pity on her. He gave her $1 and told her to run away. She went directly to the neighbors for help. They contacted Caritas.
Women are facing sexual harassment, physical abuse, verbal abuse, non-payment of salary, no day off.
That's Najla Shudri, director of Caritas in Lebanon. She says that most Ethiopian domestics like Indrani are pressured by their families to find work abroad.
They think that it's their duty to help and to support their own family. So it's always the mother encouraging the daughter to go abroad and bring some money and to support a study of the brother at the university or at school. And as they cannot do it in Ethiopia, they come to Beirut.
Shudri says the most disturbing cases involve sexual abuse.
You have some parents saying, okay, it's fine, let our son try it with a migrant worker. You have some cases where the employer, the male employer, is forcing the migrant to have some sexual relation with him.
Back at the Caritas shelter, Indrani still won't come out of her room. Nirmala says that 9 years of imprisonment have taken their toll.
She never cried, but I can see her eyes full of tears sometimes, you know. There were a few times she come to the office and she hugged me. She put her head on my shoulder and she cried. It's just like she just want to let out the pain and disappointment and suffering.
Caritas recently won a legal battle for Indrani, forcing the family that held her for 9 years to pay $7,500. That's far short of the nearly $11,000 she's owed. And so far, the family has only produced $3,500. Nirmala doubts they'll see any more. That works out to about $1 for each day Indrani worked for them. She says that at this point, all Indrani wants to do is to go back home, which should happen any day now. For the World Vision Report, this is Will Everett in Beirut.
An Indian entrepreneur introduces a rickshaw for the 21st century. More on that after a break. I'm Lita Hartman, and you're back with the World Vision Report. Bihar is the poorest state in India. Many people there rely on an old, slow, and cheap form of transportation to get around, the bicycle rickshaw. Now, a Bihar businessman has an idea that could turn those three-wheelers into big dealers. But will the rickshaw drivers themselves benefit? From the city of Patna, Peter Aronson investigates.
In the city of Patna, as in all of central India, bicycle rickshaws are a common sight. They're a critical mode of transportation, especially for the poor and working class. A rickshaw driver will pedal you and your children and your suitcases halfway across town for just 10 or 20 cents, even in scorching heat. There's not much to distinguish one from another, but on a street corner one recent morning, a group of rickshaw drivers crowd around a rickshaw that stands out. Unlike most of the city's rickshaws, which look something like 19th century Amish buggies attached to a bicycle, this is a sleek fiberglass model that has a big wide seat for the passengers and an awning over it. I've been pulling a rickshaw for 20 years and never seen one of these before, says one man. This model looks good. It'll give good business, says another. The rickshaw belongs to a company called Samman, which means dignity in Hindi. It's the brainchild of a 27-year-old entrepreneur, Irfan Alam. He has big plans for the humble bicycle rickshaw.
We thought that it could be a very good medium for outdoor advertising as well as sales and promotions.
In other words, turn these slow-moving bicycle rickshaws into slow-moving billboards. But it doesn't end there. He envisions the rickshaw turning into a kind of shop on wheels, offering passengers things
like mineral water, fruit juices. You can get your mobile recharge on rickshaws. These guys can get you the newspapers. They can deposit your utility bills.
You name it. Though most of this is still in the planning stage, Alam says the advertising, along with all those value-added services, will translate into more money for the rickshaw drivers. Most drivers are illiterate. On a good day, they'll make a little more than $1.50 after taking into account the rent they pay for the rickshaw. And if that doesn't sound like much, well, it isn't. Alam says he's trying to offer the drivers a little bit more.
And we give them a free uniform. They all are having their own identity card. These guys are insured. We give them, like, bank account.
But will the drivers have anything to put in those accounts? So far, there's been very little advertising on the rickshaws. One driver, Ramji Paswahan, has been working for Alam for 6 months. He pays the usual rickshaw rent to his boss, and he says he isn't earning anything right now beyond what little his passengers pay him. No, we don't get any other sort of money from the company, he says. We get a good uniform. See, I got this jacket for when it's cold in winter, and that is good. Paswahan fingers his thin, heavily worn windbreaker. Irfan Alam is a smooth talker. He likes to use phrases like,
I'm glad to share it with you that we are having more than 100,000 rickshaw operators registered.
And
absolutely, absolutely. That service is provided by us. And I'm glad to share it with you, Peter, that first time.
But it's hard to pin him down when it comes to specifically how much money will go to the drivers and how much will be his profit once or if the business really gets going. And when I asked a former Saman corporate donor if Alam is using the help the rickshaw drivers angle as a way to woo investors and donors, he replied, no comment. Regardless, the Saman company has gotten lots of attention in the last year. Economist Shaibal Gupta says that businessmen are not very highly regarded in this poor region.
But if you are doing some social work, then your social esteem will be high. See, it gives you certain appeal that you are doing something social entrepreneurship. But essentially, it is a business operation. I think there is nothing wrong in that.
Provided, of course, you do follow through on your promises. For the World Vision Report, I'm Peter Aronson in Patna, India.
There's a slideshow to go with this story. It's on our website, worldvisionreport.org. And later in the show, Peter tells us how he feels about riding in a rickshaw. Pop music in Patna sounds something like this. That's Genda Pool, a song from a very popular Bollywood movie called Delhi 6, and it's sung by the cast of the film. If you think the music reminds you of something, you might be right. It's composed by A.R. Rahman. He wrote the music for Slumdog Millionaire. That's what's at the top of the pops this week in India. There's a new national hero in India, and we're not talking about the stars of Slumdog Millionaire. The latest person to make headlines across the country is a 12-year-old girl named Rekha. She lives in a mud hut, a day's journey from the bustling city of Calcutta. Her area has one of India's highest illiteracy rates, and many girls are married off at a very young age. When Rekha's parents told her she had to marry, she refused. Ben Arnoldy reported the story for the Christian Science Monitor. He told his story to the World Vision Report's Peggy Waymire.
First, she learned in her schooling that the legal age to get married in India is 18, and there's a whole host of reasons why you don't want to get married young. And she really took the lessons to heart, and she also had an object lesson in her sister who got married at 11. And she had several children who died very young, partly because she had had them when she was so young. And so Rekha, essentially, she looked at her sister's life and thought, I don't really want to repeat that. But then once she said no to her parents, I mean, that's a very courageous act. And that's one of the reasons I just had to get on a plane to Calcutta to meet this girl. It blew me away that she would have the courage to do that.
You made quite a trip to do that. Wasn't it a pretty long distance to get there? And I know as a reporter, it's not always easy interviewing young kids, especially through an interpreter. How'd you get there? And what was it like talking to her?
Right. I was sort of nervous because sometimes interviewing children, it's hard. They only say yes or no to the question. And I really worried that I was going to make this huge journey and not be able to get much out of the interview, particularly since I'm a foreigner and it's through an interpreter. So, but anyway, I took the risk and went on an airplane to Calcutta and then took several hours of the train to a small city and then drove into the night from there to a small provincial capital. Then the next morning, another 2-hour drive really into the rural. It's really far out there. And got to the village and instantly were sort of surrounded by a lot of villagers wanting to know what, you know, who we are, why are we here? And so we all go as a big mob over to the house where she lives. And I, at that point, I'm really worried because this is a very high-pressure sort of scenario, I would think, for a 12-year-old girl. And it's not just me. It's one of the foreign reporters. So there's two foreign reporters who come, and the whole village is surrounding you, and they're asking you questions. And I really worried, is she going to be able to sort of put anything together? And but she was great. I mean, obviously very self-confident girl, and it was just it's fascinating what she was able to tell us.
What did she tell you?
I mean, she was talking about how it was in the evening and she was helping to roll these cigarettes and they were doing it as a family. And her parents just sort of broached the topic of, well, we're thinking of marrying you off. And she says, I just got so angry. You know, I just said, no, I don't want to get married. I really want to stay in school.
And what did her dad say to that?
Neither parent was thrilled about this. And she didn't win that initial argument. And that's not a surprise. I mean, children and families in these kind of villages, and particularly girls, they don't have a say. And what really helped down the line was that she then went to her friends who went to talk with her parents, and she went to her teachers who went and talked with them, and she even talked with one of the district supervisors overseeing this program that was kind of helping train the girls to be child activists. And the official came and talked with her parents. So all of these people in the community came and supported her and had the conversation with their folks, and that really was the thing that sort of tipped the scales so that they could come to the conclusion that, yeah, okay, we'll let her stay in school.
Hmm. Well, it seems like she didn't just get their support, but she changed some of their minds. Since she's done that, I understand there are a couple other girls in the region who have just refused to get married when their parents have arranged it.
There are two other girls in the region, and Rekha wasn't necessarily the first. There was one earlier than her, but they're all in different villages. And what's interesting about the story, I think, is that in each of those villages where those girls said no, no other parent has come forward to their young daughters and said, we want to marry you. It sort of acted as a peer pressure for the entire village.
Really? You mean all the other girls and all the other families have watched this and now the parents are no longer pressuring the girls to get married early?
Yep. In the villages where these girls are from. Yeah, so it had that nice ripple effect.
One of the things that's hard to understand is that it is illegal. It's against the law in India for girls to be married before they're 18. And yet it's almost as though they ignored that law. Why isn't this law enforced? And why was it so unusual for this girl to say no?
Well, first, there's a lot of fantastic laws in India that just aren't followed. But for this law in particular, it's difficult to enforce because it really requires there to be birth records and birth certificates. And that is something that doesn't exist in a lot of South Asian countries in a very uniform manner. So you have no way of really proving this person doesn't meet the age limit. But so that's the first problem. And then secondly, it's just hard because it is an ingrained custom. Over centuries, there's a lot of reasons why families want to do this, want to marry the girls young. First of all, this happens particularly in poor areas, and a lot of the families feel like it's one less mouth to feed if they can marry the girl off. And if the girl is older or more educated, when it comes time for that, they might have to pay a bigger dowry. So it gets more expensive the longer they wait.
Now, Ben, when you interviewed Rekha, did she tell you what her plans are for her future? Obviously, continuing school. What else?
Yes, it was very important to her to continue school, and she wanted to be a teacher when she grows up. I think she's already well on her way to teaching others a few lessons. Sounds good.
Yeah. Ben Arnoldy, reporter for the Christian Science Monitor, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
You can read Ben's story about Rekha and see photos on our website, worldvisionreport.org. In the developing world, it's not unusual for people to have no birth certificate, and that's the subject of this week's Globe at a Glance. Imagine not having a birth certificate. You couldn't get a driver's license or a passport. You might not be able to vote. In fact, your very existence could be in doubt. Millions of poor people in Africa and Asia live without these documents. They can't afford them, or the local government office is too far from home. In the developing world, it can be pretty serious not to have a birth certificate. If you can't prove your age, you can't be protected from child labor or underage marriage or even child trafficking. Now the West African country of Burkina Faso has set out to fix this. They're giving free birth certificates to more than 5 million people, most of them women and children. The government, along with UNICEF, is supplying typewriters and trained staff to make sure the papers get to the people. That's our Globe at a Glance. I'm Lita Hartman. What looks like a guitar, sounds like a ukulele, and hails from Bolivia? It's an instrument called the charango. That's Andrew Reisiger with his band playing it. When Andrew isn't making music, he's telling stories. Here he is now from Bolivia with a report about one man who is keeping the spirit of the charango alive.
In a small one-room workshop, the smell of glue and sawdust fills the air. A couple of unfinished instruments hang from nails on a paint-chipped wall. They're known as charangos. From the front, they look like shrunken guitars, around only 20 inches in length. But flip them over and the resemblance comes to a halt. One is brightly painted with a rounded body carved into the form of a mermaid, an odd image at 15,000 feet. Another uses the hairy shell of an armadillo as its back. This workshop belongs to 55-year-old René Boniface, and today he's hard at work sanding and leveling the fretboard of his next charango. Boniface is one of a handful of dedicated charango builders in Potosí, the birthplace of the instrument. He's devoted half of his life to making them. He's self-taught.
I always loved the charango as an artist. I enjoyed playing them. But unfortunately, I didn't have one myself. I had to find one so that I could continue to play it. Since I was poor, I had to make my own charango.
Boniface picks up an instrument from the floor and starts tuning it. In his large arms, the little charango looks like an infant. Upon hearing the notes, his round face lights up with a gentle smile. He turns the instrument over, revealing a carved image of Cerro Rico, or Rich Mountain, the peak that towers high above Potosí's eastern slopes.
Yo creo de que el charango tiene algo espiritual dentro de él mediante la música que emite.
I believe that the charango has something spiritual in the music it makes. Through this instrument, we can express all we feel. It's that way for me.
While Boniface perceives spirituality in the charango's music, the little instrument's origin has its roots in a dark chapter of Bolivian history. In 1544, the Spanish discovered massive silver deposits in Cerro Rico and quickly founded the city of Potosí at its base. The Spanish used indigenous and African slave labor, and it's said that you could build a bridge from Potosí to Madrid with the bones of those killed working the mines. But the mines were indirectly responsible for the birth of the charango.
Y nuestros nativos trataron de tener un instrumento similar al de ellos.
Our locals tried to imitate and copy the Spanish instruments. They invented the charango. It was a copy. For this reason, it's a hybrid. It's mestizo.
What Boniface's ancestors were imitating was the vihuela, the precursor to the modern-day Spanish guitar. At the time, there were no other stringed instruments in this part of the world.
Because they were readily available, people also built charangos using armadillo shells. It's a common animal here, and it has the right shape and qualities.
Over the centuries, musicians have blended local mythology into its use.
Tradicionalmente, en las comunidades, los charangueros depositan su charango en algunas.
Traditionally, in the communities, musicians place their charangos next to streams or alongside waterfalls, so that they will be tuned in such a way that when the musician plays the instrument, it sounds enchanted. There are also traditions that say you should put charms or amulets in the charango in order to woo women.
Today, the charango represents common ground. Musicians descended from both the Inca and the Spanish play the instrument, and it's been incorporated into most aspects of daily life.
Bueno, el charango nosotros los potosinos lo llevamos muy, muy dentro nuestro porque nos acompaña en todas nuestras fiestas.
The charango is something that we hold very dear. It accompanies us in all of our festivals, religious and pagan ceremonies, planting and harvesting. There is a saying that the campesino is born with the charango in one hand.
Uphill from Boniface's workshop, there's a city park. In the distance, the giant peak of Cerro Rico rises up from the maze of cobblestone streets and shanty towns. Local people call the park the Plaza del Charango. It's named after René Boniface's most ambitious undertaking, a monument dedicated to the charango. In the center of the plaza, a pair of pigeons sits atop a larger-than-life instrument the color of rust. At the base of this 20-foot-tall charango are carved the words Potosí Cuna del Charango, or Potosí, Cradle of the Charango. For the World Vision Report, I'm Andrew Reisiger in Potosí, Bolivia.
You can see a slideshow and hear more charango music on our website, worldvisionreport.org. A bucket, a faucet, and some really dirty cars. A Zimbabwean refugee finds that's all it takes to start a successful business just south of the border. That's coming up on the World Vision Report. Stay with us. You're back with the World Vision Report. I'm Lita Hartman, in for Peggy Wehmeyer. The World Bank announced a few days ago that it was funneling $22 million to Zimbabwe. That's the first injection of World Bank capital there since 2001. The money won't go to the government, but to aid agencies and church groups that help small farmers and poor people. But this aid comes too late to help the estimated 3 million people who've already left the country, fleeing the economic meltdown there. Many of them have headed south to South Africa. That's what a 31-year-old van driver we'll call Joe Moyo did. He jumped a freight train in Zimbabwe and got off in Musina, just 10 miles over the border into South Africa. Moyo soon discovered that jobs are hard to come by in South Africa. So, desperate to earn money to send back to his wife and kids, Moyo decided to start his own business. Tendai Maposa brings us the next segment in our street vendor series.
A few weeks after arriving in Musina, Joe Moyo got his asylum papers. Then he did odd jobs such as loading or unloading trucks. But while walking around town, he kept his eyes wide open.
I saw there was only one car wash in town. And I said, I can clean cars. Let me just try to open one. And the response was very, 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 very good.
Moyo's car wash is rudimentary, to say the least. He set up shop on a street corner and has to fetch water in old plastic buckets from an outdoor faucet and uses simple household cleaning materials. But the business is slowly competing for customers with the high-tech establishment in town because his customers say he gives better service. But that's created a problem. The growing clientele means it takes too long to clean a car.
With the buckets, I will take maybe 20 to 30 minutes inside and outside. So I'm trying to get a hose pipe and the vacuum cleaner.
He says sometimes 7 or 8 cars line up for his service. This has forced him to employ help, 2 fellow asylum seekers from Zimbabwe. One of them, John Dube, also not his real name, is polishing the tires of a car he has just cleaned.
Yeah, South Africans, they like this type of
rims and tires which are shining, you see, bling, bling. We call it in Harare. So, yeah, I don't know what they call it. Some in Joburg, they call it Joburg style. Yeah. So we are trying to represent their style, keep in touch, moving with them, satisfy them. We hope we will satisfy them more. And we are looking for more customers.
Indeed, the South African customers at Moyo's Car Wash were very happy with the service.
Here is the best. The best car washes. It's washing very nice.
Yeah, these guys, they are the best, you know, because they need more customers.
And more customers is what Moyo needs. Besides paying for his everyday requirements, he also needs money to send back home to support his family.
They are the people that I came here for. So I should make something out of this.
He says, despite the fact that there is a new government in Zimbabwe, reports from home suggest nothing much has changed. People are still struggling to get life's basics, and he's not planning to go back anytime soon. For the World Vision Report, I'm Tendai Maposa in Musina, South Africa.
Many of those who leave Zimbabwe for South Africa are children. When Tendai Maposa was in the border town of Musina, he saw scores of youngsters roaming the streets there. Here's one young man's story in his own words.
My name is Kenneth Gerrera. I am 17 years old, and I come from Zaka in Zimbabwe. I've been in Musina for 3 months. I used to go to school, but stopped when my mother, who used to pay the fees for me, died. So I told my father I wanted to go to South Africa to look for some work so I could earn money to help him and my siblings. My father sold a goat and a pig for my trip. When I got to the South African side, I went through a hole in the fence to get to the taxi stand. I had to pay 150 rand, about $15, to people who manned the holes to be let through. When I got here, I worked for a month as a gardener. At the end of the month, the person I worked for refused to pay me, saying I was an illegal alien. I have done peace jobs for others since, but even though I have been granted asylum, I cannot find any real work and live from hand to mouth. I make money from jobs such as offloading trucks or carrying people's groceries from the supermarket to their cars. I have heard that there is a new government in Zimbabwe. Life is hard here, and if I get enough money, I'd like to go back. Life is too tough here. When you are at home, you have your family around you, supporting you.
That was Kenneth Gerrera in his own words. Many people these days are finding they just don't have enough money to pay the bills. But it was like that for many folks even before the current recession. A surprise medical bill or car trouble could use up the money meant for next month's rent. That's just what happened to Keith Taylor when he was in graduate school. Keith's car had broken down, and after he had it repaired, there was nothing left in the bank. He told his story to the World Vision Report's Peggy Waymire.
I came about 4 days from being evicted from my apartment. And, you know, when you're facing, really facing homelessness, it impacts every part of your life. So, I mean, I lived a long way from home. I didn't have anywhere to go. I mean, I would have just been out on the street. And the way that that finally was resolved is that a coworker of mine heard about my situation. And when I told him, it was really embarrassing to have to tell him about it, because frankly, when your life comes down to $500, it's humiliating, right? But he finally coaxed it out of me, and I told him, and his response was, well, you know, I hope you get that worked out. And then the next day I came to work, and he had left me a check for the amount of my rent, and he was the reason that I didn't get evicted.
When you got out of graduate school, unlike a lot of people in really bad straits, you ended up getting a good job.
I was very, very fortunate. I ended up getting, you know, my career was always in academics. That's what I wanted to go into. And I taught medieval British literature and Anglo-Saxon linguistics.
How did you go from teaching medieval British literature to this project you're involved in?
Well, what actually happened is that one night on the way home from a night class, I was thinking about just how lucky I was. And I thought to myself, you know, I wouldn't be here if it hadn't been for those people who had been there for me, those two or three critical moments in my life, and these little things that I had never forgotten. And I thought to myself, you know what? When I'm rich, I'm going to do that for other people, because those folks really changed my life. As soon as the words were sort of out of my head, I stopped and I remembered what the word philanthropy actually means. This is one of those obscure things that I knew from my training. And the word philanthropy actually from Greek means compassion for people. There's no money attached to the word philanthropy. And I thought to myself, these people who helped me, these people were philanthropists in the truest sense of the word.
So you took that idea and you ran with it. Where did you go next with that idea?
I decided that what I was going to do, I was going to downsize my life to the point that I had 10% of my gross income left over every month. And I was going to take that money, which would have been $350 a month when this started, and I was going to use that to carry on the tradition of helping individual people with these short-term crises in exactly the way that other people had helped me.
Did you do that? I mean, how did you find people to give that money to?
That's a great question. What actually happened is that I started thinking about, okay, logistically, how am I going to find people who I can help for $350 a month? Because it's not a lot of money. And truthfully, I knew that my friends, my contacts, even if I told them I wanted to do this, they would never come to me and ask me for help, because really, as I learned, it's humiliating to have to ask for something so small and really, really need it. So what I decided I would do is open a very dinky website. I called it Modest Needs because it seemed very appropriate for what I was trying to do. And that webpage, what it said was, if you have a short-term emergency and you don't qualify for any kind of assistance through any of the programs that we already have to help folks who need assistance, let me know and I'll do what I can.
I'm interested in what the response was. How many people went to that website and actually contacted you?
The original plan was for maybe two or three people would ask for something and I'd be able to help one of them. In fact, what happened is that on April 1st, 2002, I'll never forget the date, I went to check my email in the morning, and, you know, I normally had, you know, 10, 12 emails that would come in mostly from students. I went to check my email, and there were, I think, 1,700 emails. 5 or 10% of them, because of the timing, you know, it was April 1st, said, you know, you must be kidding, nobody would do this. Another 5 or 10% said literally things like this. My doctor says that I have a lump in my chest and I need to have a biopsy and I don't have medical insurance and the biopsy is going to cost $300. Can you help me? All of the rest of the mail, about 80% of what I got, said something almost exactly along these lines. This country has needed this for a long time. Where can I send you a check? 10 days later, I get this frantic call from my office at work. Dr. Taylor, the Today Show is looking for you. I had no idea what I was really dealing with until I saw the results of that. You know, tens of thousands of people in this country with $100 and $200 critical needs writing in and begging for help.
So when somebody comes to your website for help, is there a typical request? What kinds of things are people asking for?
Well, I think the most common type of application that we get is for help with a single month's rent or mortgage because they've already incurred, an emergency medical bill, an emergency auto repair.
the cynic in me has to ask, how do you vet these people with so many requests or applications coming in? How do you know they're telling you the truth about their small crises?
Actually, that is most of the job that we do at Modest Needs at this point. The first step of our vetting process is to look at it at face value, right? As if what they have told us is accurate, and ask ourselves whether that would qualify for one of our three grant types at face value. Then we ask them to provide us with situation-specific documentation. We not only get a series of standard documents like a photo ID, a copy of a lease or a mortgage payment coupon, we also look at the application itself, and we determine what we need to request from them based on what they've told us has happened.
What's the most moving request you've gotten?
The most moving ever for me was from a woman in Kentucky who was a teacher. Their oldest child was about to start kindergarten, and he had an eye disorder called Ehlers syndrome that causes the corneas in your eye to not be able to process shape, only color. You can buy glasses to fix this, but they're extraordinarily expensive because they have to be tailored to the defects in the cornea that they're going to correct. So the cost for the lenses is about $550. This woman wrote in and asked for a $50 down payment to be able to go ahead and get the glasses her son needed so that he could start kindergarten being able to see, and told us that if we would help with the $50 down payment, she would get a second job to pay off the rest of this $550 bill. And so we funded that application not for $50, right? We made her a deal that we would buy the lenses if she would buy the frames. And what we found out later is that they went to the optician to get the glasses fitted, and they put the glasses on her little boy, and he looked at his mom, and he said, "Mom, is that you?" And it turned out that that was the first time he had ever seen his mother, ever, for $550.
Keith Taylor of Modest Needs, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. It's really been a pleasure to speak with you.
Keith Taylor founded the organization Modest Needs. For more information, go to our website at worldvisionreport.org. Earlier in the show, we heard Peter Aronson's story from India about a rickshaw business that plans to offer customers more than just wheels. Many people in India use rickshaws, but Peter, who's lived there for the past 3 years, recoils at the idea of using another human being to get around.
I mean, why should they toil so that I don't have to? I took a bicycle rickshaw once when I had heat stroke, but I didn't feel good about it. Another time, I took one in Nepal because the taxis and buses were on strike. I felt embarrassed that one man's legs were working to pull me, my wife, our suitcases, and the big rickshaw down a dusty lane for 3 hours. But he didn't seem to mind at all. After a while, as my self-consciousness waned a bit, I noticed how pleasant it was, for us anyway, to ride slowly through the fields and past the water buffalo, making chit-chat with other bicycle riders along the way. Even so, I couldn't help but think of the hard work it was for the man doing the pedaling. A question rattled around in my mind. Was I exploiting him? In Patna, capital of the Indian state of Bihar, I got to hear the rickshaw puller side of the story. Most of them are uneducated. They work as farm laborers 2 or 3 months a year when there's work. But when the farming season's over, they come to the cities and drive bicycle rickshaws. On a good day, they can earn as much as 100 rupees, about $2, from 10 or 15 rides. That money keeps them above India's poverty line. India, as one economist pointed out to me, is a low-opportunity society. And Bihar, one of India's poorest states, is especially so. So the fact that these men can use their leg power to earn that $2 a day means at least they have some kind of opportunity. I'd always thought it was better to take an auto rickshaw, a three-wheeled vehicle that sounds like it's powered by a motorcycle or lawnmower engine. I mean, it gets you there faster and nobody has to sweat. But as someone in Patna rightly pointed out to me, bicycle rickshaws don't pollute. There are 100,000 rickshaws in Patna and 10 million in India. If they were all suddenly replaced by carbon-belching auto rickshaws, it would seriously hurt the environment. Plus, I was told, bicycle rickshaws aren't just for wealthy people to ride on and feel grand. When poor villagers come to cities to find a doctor, they can't afford motorized transport, but they can afford a few rupees for a rickshaw. Finally, there's the issue of age. Some of the rickshaw pullers look young and strong, but many are old, gray, and worn with age. I especially never wanted to subject these men to the work of pulling my weight. But then I met an older driver who told me how hard it is to see customers choose the younger drivers, even though he's still feeling strong and healthy. So now when I look at the bicycle rickshaws lined up on the curb, I still see a symbol of exploitation, but I also see an environmentally friendly form of transportation and a little bit of economic opportunity.
Peter Aronson is a freelance reporter based in northern India. And that's it for this week. If you want to find out more about any of the stories or interviews you've heard today, you can do that on our website, worldvisionreport.org. While you're there, you can download a podcast or read blogs from our reporters across the globe. The program is produced by Beverly Abel and edited by Diane Toomey. Our producers are Christina Darden, Cynthia Graber, and Susan Shepherd. Doug Boyles and Mark Bandy are our audio engineers. Larry Short is our interactive editor. And I'm Lita Hartman. Thanks for listening.
This program is produced with funding from World Vision. The views expressed in this show are not necessarily those of the organization.